A week ago, we were on our way back from Buffalo and we stopped at Seneca Falls to visit the Women's Rights National Historical Park. I didn't know this, but when they first met in July of 1848, they met at Wesleyan Methodist Chapel, which is where the museum now is. I was so struck by their declaration of sentiments, which they crafted, outlining a very long list of rights denied to women, not least of them the right to vote. Along the way, I was struck by this one. He allows her in church, but in a subordinate position, claiming apostolic authority for her exclusion from the ministry, and with some exceptions, from any public participation in the affairs of the church. And I thought to myself, wow, Lutherans only allowed women to be ordained into the ministry in 1970. And other denominations, including other Lutheran denominations, still don't ordain women as pastors or priests. So I found myself walking through Seneca Falls, reflecting on the struggles of women today that still, in so many regards, do not have access to the same opportunities and rewards as men. Like, for example, I was reflecting on the pay gap, which hasn't really budged in 15 years. Women making 83 cents to every dollar men earn. And with a ruling by the Supreme Court in the Dobbs versus Jackson case, people with uteruses, women of course, but trans men and non-binary folks, are stripped of their constitutional protection of the right to bodily autonomy. It feels like forces in society are trying to push women backwards, downwards, back to the subordinate position the framers of the Declaration of Sentiments called out 174 years ago. So it feels really crucial to highlight the feminist Jesus. And it's nowhere more clear than with the Jesus we meet in Luke's gospel. Scholars have long pointed out that Luke lifts up the role of women, giving them very prominent places in the story. Think about the beginning of Luke. Mary and Elizabeth both hear directly from the angels and function as agents of God's intended actions on their own terms, separate from their husbands. Throughout the gospel, Luke often includes pairings. Like in chapter 7, there's the healing of the centurion's slave, followed by the resurrection of the widow's son. Or in chapter 13, Jesus is using examples of the reign of God. So he says the reign of God is like a man planting a mustard seed, or it's like a woman working yeast into the bread dough. One scholar argues these pairings, these lifting up of the role of women as equal in Luke's gospel, seeks to present women in a new light as an oppressed group set free by the ministry of Jesus. It is the women, after all, who are the first preachers of the resurrection. It's in this context that I want to look at this famous story of Mary and Martha. Jesus comes to a town and Martha welcomes him into her home, and this scene ensues in which Martha is cast in a traditional female role, presumably preparing a meal for their important guest. Mary, on the other hand, takes the traditional posture of a male disciple, sitting at the feet of Jesus and listening to his teaching. Luke, as we know from his later writing in the Acts of the Apostles, lived during a time when Christians met in homes, and some of these homes were women's homes, including Lydia, after whom St. Lydia's is named, who in Acts 16 invites Paul and Timothy to stay with her in her home. So the scene here, which is found only in Luke's gospel, might have a special importance for Luke. It may be Luke's effort to show Jesus valuing women as disciples in the front row of the class, so to speak, and not relegated to the kitchen. In the strictly hierarchical world of the Roman Empire, early Christian churches were criticized for including women and children in their membership. It was unheard of. And so it became a distinctive mark of Christian community and one of the reasons for its growth in the early centuries. So while Jesus may have sought to open new possibilities for all people who were in some way disregarded, who were not treated as beloved by God and made in God's image, the church largely lost track of this. By the fourth century, it had become deeply patriarchal, much like the societies around it. And in order to defend its embrace of patriarchal power, it had to lessen the power, the revolutionary power of stories like this. After Constantine's conversion in 312, he worked to create a two-tier status system in which religious people followed the commandment not to kill, and lay people could serve in the army and kill. And so the story began to be interpreted as Mary representing the life of contemplative monks and nuns, the true holy people, and Martha represented the everyday life of the laity, following necessary but lesser callings, including serving in the military. That they had to work so hard to dismiss this text shows how shocking and revolutionary it was in its original context. The story, and many other stories like it in the gospel, show the male disciples and other men offended by Jesus' inclusion of women in his inner circle. So I think Luke envisioned his original hearers naturally siding with Martha, expecting Jesus to reprimand Mary and put her in her place. But instead, Jesus says that Mary has chosen, in Greek it says, agathon merida, a good portion. So her choice was not a wrong choice, not an inappropriate choice, but Jesus said a good choice to act in that way of listening to and learning from him and pursuing this religious vocation of discipleship. He, in fact, says it's the one necessary thing. In the end, though, I don't think the story is only about Jesus' radical inclusion of women into leadership, but about the limited imagination of his hearers. Luke envisions his story with Jesus challenging the way we, the hearers of the story, so easily draw distinctions and place ourselves on the preferred side. Jesus, by way of provoking us, wants to work on our hearts. That's how I read Luke in writing this story. Jesus wants us, too, to open our hearts to the one who has been left out, and to sharpen it a bit, to open our hearts to the one our society or religion has decided it is okay to leave out, the one who in some way we regard as disposable. Through our life together as church, through the stories we share, through the meal we share, we become slowly but surely more like Jesus in refusing systems and structures and laws that force anyone, any group, into a subordinate position. That, if you will, is who we are becoming as a Christian community, a people who refuse others' disposability. Women, queer folk, BIPOC folk, every sort of rainbow person God has made, and the earth we live on, too. None are disposable. Now, I know I don't always get it right. That's why I say becoming Christian. So let me close with a favorite quote of mine from Martin Luther, who once said, "I'm not a Christian, but I'm becoming one." I like that. I wonder what it might be like to put it on our website. We are not Christians, but we are becoming ones. Or to put a sign on our front door at St. Lydia's, warning, work in progress. Well, we share the sermon at St. Lydia's, so let's pause for a moment of reflection and then I'll invite you to share stories or experiences that this scripture text or my reflections sparked for you.